This week on The Encrypted Economy, we explore IoT devices and specifically how we're securing them with Paul Clayson, CEO of AgilePQ. Paul has had an impressive career, including acting as chief of staff for congressional members and leading multiple technology-focused companies prior to becoming the CEO of AgilePQ. We consider the proliferation of IoT devices and the lack of awareness as to how IoT vulnerabilities can compromise all the systems in the network that they are tied to. One of the big things that differentiates IoT risks from other system risks is the scale of its deployment and the challenges of identifying all those devices when they're deployed, whether that's at the home level or at the enterprise level. AgilePQ solutions use advanced encryption techniques that anticipate the further evolution of cybersecurity threats in a post-quantum computing era, hence the PQ after Agile. I am sure you'll enjoy this episode with Paul as much as I did. And of course, if you like the show, I encourage you to subscribe, share with your friends, and leave feedback. Welcome to The Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. This is Eric Hess from The Encrypted Economy, and today I am super excited to have Paul Clayson of AgilePQ on our show. Paul has a very interesting, accomplished background in technologies. He leads a company now that's very focused on IoT security encryption, which is near and dear to The Encrypted Economy's heart. With that said, Paul, so happy to have you on the show. Why don't you introduce yourself?
It's a delight. Thank you for inviting us, and we're delighted to be here. I'm coming to you out of Utah right now. I've got my ski vest on, hope to hit the slope sometime this weekend, but really happy to be on the show.
We don't hit the slopes in New Jersey. They tend to be fairly melted. So, Paul, you had a very interesting background. You grew up in rural Idaho. You spent time in D.C., and you've had a lot of leadership roles. But why don't you give us a little more background on your journey to becoming the CEO of AgilePQ?
That's a big task. But yeah, I did grow up on a potato farm, grain farm, cattle ranch in Idaho, and got my roots there. I graduated from a very small high school. I think we had 59 in our total graduating class. But it installed a lot of good values in me and work ethic. And on that farm, we had to learn to work. Sometimes we were up all night birthing a calf that was coming breech in a cow. Sometimes we would have to be on combines all night because a storm was coming and we had to get the grain out of the field. And it was very hard work. And I couldn't wait after I got out of high school to get off that farm so I didn't have to work so hard. And then I later started doing technology startups. And now I would really like to go back to the farm so I don't have to work so hard. Technology startups, they are a consuming effort. I spent a period of time full-time in politics. I started out of high school, lived in California for a couple of years, did some religious education there. Then I got into school and did real estate syndication going through school. Then I got into politics, managed a congressional campaign, went to Washington, was chief of staff to a couple of congressmen, worked for a couple of presidents, moved to Portland, Oregon after doing lots of campaign and political work, and then was in a money management firm for a number of years and doing a lot of investment work. Then I moved over to the side. I wanted to get into the technology side. I wanted to be where the action was in technology growth. And since that time, I've ended up at first in a senior management role with a speech recognition technology company, and then started in my role as CEO of different kinds of technologies that are leading edge. That includes nanotechnology and solar energy and PCB manufacturing and encryption technology and softwares of different kinds. But the common thread through all of those has been that I learned how to develop strategy very early on. I had to do that in the political arena, and I learned how to develop strategy and put tactics behind it to accomplish it. And so that's how I got here, and that's what I deploy as a CEO.
Excellent. I've heard some stories about your early life on the farm, and I'm not directing you to the farm for the answer to this next question. What experience in your life has, when you think about a singular event, has most shaped your values? Something that happened that has just really stuck with you even to this day?
There really are a total of three events, but let me share just really briefly two of them. One was I was head of a civic organization that was trying to help people in their lives through everything from income and economic issues to personal issues and so forth. And we had a team of people that were really working on it. And we invited a family in who had experienced some real challenges in their life to come in and meet with us. And I just wanted to meet them. They brought their whole family, and in walks this family. And there was one little girl that walked in. And as I went to shake her hand, when I met her, she put her hand out and she had no hand. She had, instead of hands, she had two stumps. She was born without hands. And she was this smiling, beautiful little girl. And we had a great meeting with them and discussed a lot of things. And as I went to leave, this beautiful little girl came up to me and I thanked her for coming. And she had those two little stumps together holding something. And as she held those two little stumps together, I said, "I'll shake both of your hands." And she said, "No, I want to give you this." And she pulled those stumps together and out dropped a penny. And I said, "Why are you giving me this penny?" And she said, "Because I feel so good in here and I know you need help for other people."
Wow.
Here was a little tiny girl that had a severe handicap for the rest of her life. And she was telling me how she could help us. And to this day, I keep that penny on my desk.
Oh, wow.
A dear friend of mine put it in a frame and I keep that on my desk to ground me and remind me. And the second experience was really had to do with my father growing up. He was a World War II veteran, and he was on Omaha Beach on D-Day, and he was a medic. And I learned, he would never talk about his experience there, but I learned about some of the things he did on D-Day as a medic when he was up on that beach, and he would crawl out into open fire on the sand and grab people who were wounded, bring them back behind a shelter. And there he would either fix their wounds and then do it again, or he would grab their hand and hold their hand and pray with them until they passed on. You and I have opportunities and exist in this world, in America, because we stand on the shoulders of giants. My dad came home from the war and rode his horse up to the ridge above his farm and said, "I'm never leaving here again." And that was largely true. He stayed to that farm the rest of his life. And yet, while not known to the world, he is a giant. And we must always remember that. And that's guided my journey as well.
Wow. Those are powerful experiences. I got to make sure I ask that question in the future. I don't know if I'll get the same responses. And so pivoting to your company now, what is Agile PQ's core values? How would you define them?
Our core values are really simple. The very first one is do the right thing always. Do the right thing always. The second is don't get caught becoming very good at doing something we have no business doing at all. Companies get caught up in the thick of thin things and they just can't get out of it at times. So you end up with never finish syndromes and feature creeps. And that's not fair to shareholders. It's not fair to customers. And it's not fair to vendors who are supplying to you. You have to keep focused on the things you should be doing and the right things at all times. You have to be true to your vision. You have to know what your vision is and go after that vision. You have to be transparent. Transparency means everything. Even when times are bad in a company, I believe you have to be transparent. It can be scary to employees. They may look at things and say, "We don't have enough money to continue. We don't have enough infrastructure to continue." It's scary for them. It's scary for all of us at times. But the transparency allows people to look at things and say, "How can I step up and help?" And it really separates in a company those who are cut out to be in a startup and those who are not. And that transparency really helps. Those are some of our key core values.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we'll explain too. So turning now to the tech itself, everybody knows IoT, this great mesh, right? That's gradually encompassing our homes, our businesses, interrelated internet connected devices that can collect and transfer data over wireless networks without humans intervening. So that would cut out your mobile phone. That would cut out like a crypto wallet. That would cut out your laptop. But almost everything else is pretty wide. And so as we look at what IoT is, does IoT have a last mile issue in terms of security?
Yeah, I think maybe a more accurate question, Eric, is to rather than saying, do some of these devices have a last mile security problem? It's how many devices don't? it's all over. And there's a reason for that. It's because they have extraordinarily small processors that can't run the security that's on your smartphone or your laptop. And that security has been in place for over 20 years. It was put in place by the U.S. federal government and adopted by the world as an encryption and a security and a transmission protocol that has governed that for many years. But the truth is, to generate just one encrypted message and to secure one piece of data on your smartphone, the operating code footprint of that is so large, it can't fit on a smart thermostat in your home. So these devices have gone to market without a security. And think about that for a second, because these IoT devices are amazing. They are really impacting our life. Think about the future and the rise of autonomous driverless cars, or think about the rise of data available to traditional driver vehicles where you can see your position on the road or in a lane or other drivers or notifications for preventive maintenance or all of those kinds of things. Think about the way it can improve machines in every way. Think about, just to name a couple of others, think about the customer service and customer experience that it can provide. It can provide data collection for analysis. It can track high-value assets wherever they are in the world, whether that be a high-priced item that's shipping or whether it be police evidence file so that it never goes missing. It can provide agricultural tracking for certified materials. And here you think about organic agriculture. How do you know if it's organic? IoT devices can certify that certain things are done in the field that leads to organic production for the consumer. And maybe one last one, it can insert into a human body, say everything from insulin to cancer drugs to electronic control of heart rates, and be adjusted to changing needs without surgery and without even a visit to the medical office. But if you consider the damaging impact of any one of those examples I just gave, and there are thousands more, but the damaging impact of any one of those examples, if that IoT device were subject to unauthorized intrusion, or if the device received a data hack, where that device or that data could be controlled by a bad actor. And the impact of that IoT and data collection in the wrong hands is frightening at best, and it's devastating in general, but it's catastrophic at worst, because the loss of assets is debilitating, but the loss of life is horrendous. And that data and sometimes the function of those devices in the wrong hands can lead to any one of those outcomes.
Yeah, it's funny. Even before this call, I was looking into apparently doorbells. There was a UK group that researched some of Amazon's Best Buys, their recommended one. And apparently a few of these did nothing to secure the router password, the Wi-Fi network names or passwords. And in one case, they found that these were actually being sent unencrypted back to servers in China. And these are being marketed throughout the US and UK. Stunning that you hook something up to your home or you hook something up to your local Wi-Fi and you think, oh, it's just an IoT device. It's just, maybe it's just checking my coffee or it's just my doorbell. But in fact, what it's actually doing is exposing your entire network. And in the case of sending it outside the country, is just, it's stunning.
It is stunning. And in fact, these IoT devices are just as exploitable as desktops and servers and phones and so forth. And they're connected to the same networks. In fact, they are actually vastly more exploitable because they don't have the resources to run the threat detection or the policy enforcement or antivirus type programs that are on your laptop or your smartphone that require more powerful machines to run. They often lack a user interface. So that means that a compromise to a device could remain dormant and undetected on an IoT device for a very long time, and nobody knows it's there because there's not an interface to tell them that it's there. So securing these devices become enormously important, and the data might seem low value, that it doesn't matter if somebody knows what temperature setting is on my connected thermostat in my house. But it's very valuable in the aggregate. And this is why companies are deploying these devices, because the devices and the data they're collecting are valuable, but it's not treated as valuable. Maybe illustrate this point. Some of the reasons people might hack an IoT device is to do what's called a distributed denial of service attack, where they would stitch together devices from maybe a million different IoT devices and attack a web server somewhere to shut down the access to the internet or the data delivery system. They can deliver malware, malicious code or software. They can do something that's called passive wiretapping. That's like the wiretapping that the FBI did in the past with phone lines. Now they can wiretap straight into data or collect additional data or listen through a device to conversations. There are other things that are called SQLI and even war driving. War driving is, it's sometimes called war biking or war cycling or war walking. It's when someone goes by a facility and they're searching for Wi-Fi wireless networks and to exploit those networks. And even software for war driving is freely available on the internet. And then maybe most concerning of all, and there's many other reasons, but maybe most concerning of all is nation state digital warfare, where cyber warfare hackers are constantly attacking government agencies and critical infrastructures and industries that are vendors to them, and especially if they contain known sensitive data or property in some way. And the hackers are looking for data that will benefit the country's economy and strengthen their own business and military strategies. But this can extend to nation states hacking into consumer devices, and then they lie in wait. Remember, there's no user interface on many of these. So they just lie in wait on that devices until a time when they feel they need to shut it down or manipulate it to create mass panic or confusion. Think here about what would happen if someone was able to shut down a smart thermostat in the middle of winter, shut off the furnace, or if they were able to shut down an insulin pump or manipulate a smart vehicle and cause mass panic to affect a nation's economy and affect the nation's mindset. Those are really serious, and they're all coming through both government, commercial, and consumer devices.
Yeah, it can also provide that gateway to even larger systems. We're a couple of years removed from the Target hack, but as you recall, that started with HVAC software, not IoT, but it could have just as easily been originating from HVAC IoT device. Even in the past year, they found in the Philips Hue smart bulb, apparently there were some vulnerabilities in that could allow you to basically access the entire operating system that's behind the smart bulb control. And it would trick people into showing the bulb as unreachable. They would install an update, and all of a sudden they would upload all this malware. Even if the device itself can't transmit that payload in conjunction with another tool or device by the hackers, it could, because it could trigger an action that then results in that being uploaded. So they could work in concert. So it gets pretty complicated.
In our country, actually, from a nation state standpoint, nation states engage in this kind of activity all day long, including the United States. We do this. The differences in some nation states is their motivation for doing that. In the United States, we typically try to do this for national security and protect assets and intellectual property and citizens and so forth in our country. There are some other nation states that will collect that for economic advantage, to steal IP, to steal secrets, to steal know-how. And they may have companies who have secrets like that, may have it locked down inside of their companies. But what if the Secretary of Defense had a smart thermostat? Or what if they had a smart doorbell that was also hooked to an intercom system so that they could answer who's at the door remotely? What if a nation state could listen into that on a clandestine basis and know what was being said in private conversations? It gets to be extremely, extremely serious when we start talking about those kinds of events.
And we know it's sad, but often the people at the top, they're the worst offenders. They don't have time to be worried about this security stuff. I've seen it time and time again where the whole company can be buttoned down, but the CEO is sending out sensitive financial reports via Gmail, right?
I'm reminded of the story. There was a U.S. general who was told that the U.S. military and DOD sites were being hacked on a regular basis. And his staff tried to commit him to put software on so they could see how often and where those attacks were coming from. And he finally consented. He said they didn't need it. He didn't believe these attacks were real. After 2 weeks of showing the attacks, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of attacks, and they were getting deep into the system. And they came back and told the general, here's what we found just by putting this software on. And the general immediately said, you're under order to remove that software from our websites immediately. And they said, why? And he said, because we weren't hacked until you put that software on our system. Sometimes people don't understand technology and what has to happen to move very fast to keep up with the bad actors.
I'm sure there's plenty of stories like that. And it's also funny because, and I know I'm stealing one of your pages, but I'm part of the shared assessment framework, so I guess I'm allowed. But basically, one of the first things that you do when you're doing an assessment of a company for security is you have to take inventory. You have to take inventory of all your assets. But the Santa Fe group basically solicited responses from hundreds of companies, and only 25% of the respondents said that they were even aware of all their IoT devices. It's difficult to really put their fingers around the extent of their IoT exposure.
Exactly. In fact, their study showed that 50% of companies don't have a listing of their IoT devices at all. Their workers are disallowed to put them on the system without recording a list at all. About 50% were aware of some, but only 25% said they were aware of all. And among those, it was even doubtful if all of them understood. That is very scary. If you don't know where all of your devices are, how can you secure them? How can you create a network system that secures all of that?
There was another statistic that just blew me away on that. So only 14% of the respondents said that if they were aware of a security problem on an IoT device, that they would immediately replace it. Most said that they would not replace it at all. Even if they knew there was a security issue, they would not replace it. Why? Actually, maybe you can tell us why.
I think the why comes in a few different formats. Some of it is lack of education, that there are methods to do it or that there are reasons why you should do it. Two is there may mistakenly be some thought process. What is somebody going to do with an off-on switch? What is somebody going to do with a temperature sensor? There's nothing they can do with this. There's no problem with this. Why should I do that? The third is probably economic. This increases the cost of my system, or it's perceived that it will in some substantial way. Actually, with our technology, we don't increase the cost that much, and we can secure all of those devices. But I think people perceive that they have to add a lot of hardware to be able to run the kind of legacy encryption or security that's on your smartphone. And that's not true in today's world, but I think that's a misconception. And then some is just simply that they don't believe that if there were a breach, that the breach would rise to the level of putting in place massive security practices and functions. So they'll just take the occasional breach that comes along and they'll deal with it. And to date, there hasn't been a multi-billion dollar award for a breach. The minute that comes, companies are going to start thinking twice about getting more security on these devices. I think all of those are probably reasons. There are some, I won't state who, but there was a massive breach a while back of a doorbell system. It was reported in the news. We contacted that company right away and said, we think we can actually fix this for the future for you. And the immediate response, didn't look at the technology, didn't study it, didn't want a PowerPoint, didn't look at anything, just said, yeah, we don't need it. We don't have a security problem on these devices. So we've got to change a mindset. And that mindset, quite frankly, has to be changed at the boardroom level and in senior management, but even the boardroom level, if enough members of boards of directors started saying, I want to report every board meeting about how secure we are and how many of our IoT devices are secure and where is our liability now and in the future and what we're going to do about it, things start to change pretty quickly.
And I want to get back to that because I think education is important, and it'd be interesting to see how the people you're talking to break down between those who get it right off, those who need some data, some convincing, and those who just simply can never get it. But before we do that, Agile PQ, the P doesn't stand for Paul, it stands for post-quantum. So why should we be worried about post-quantum IoT today?
There's this coming innovation of quantum technologies that is really phenomenal. It's going to bring a lot of computing advantages to the world that can solve all kinds of problems. These are computers that don't use regular computer code, binary code. That's ones and zeros used to build binary code. They use something called quantum bits or qubits. And that code that is used can basically process data, multiple streams of data simultaneously, whereas binary code can only process a linear function. It has to process everything, one function, one after the next. So that ability to process multiple systems and multiple data at once leads to the ability to create massive processing capability in a very short amount of time. A year and a half ago, Google announced that they had a functioning quantum computer. Small, couldn't do a lot, but that functioning quantum computer alone could process in under a minute an amount of data that would take the world's largest supercomputer 10,000 years to process. That's phenomenal processing power. Now, that's never going to end up on your, never's too strong, I won't say that. That likely isn't going to end up on your laptop or your smartphone or in your server that you use, because they're used only for certain things like artificial intelligence or molecular modeling or even mass cryptography itself or financial modeling, physics or astronomy studies. Those are the kinds of things where there will be massive breakthroughs with quantum computers. But here's the thing. If those quantum computers can break, can process through so much data so quickly, they can break current encryption that's on the market today, that's on your smartphone and that's on your laptop. They can break that kind of encryption. So the benefit of these quantum computers is massive, but the threat of these quantum computers is huge as well. There are nation states now who are hacking into systems and downloading encrypted data off of companies and governments' storage banks, and they are storing that data. They can't, perhaps they can't break the encryption today, but shortly when quantum computers are available, they'll break that encryption and they'll have that data. So this, it's a serious problem. Well, when you think about this, the encryption that's on your smartphone today can't be run on an IoT computer. So one of the things that we did as a company in Agile PQ is we created an extraordinarily agile code that is very small and can operate on the smallest of IoT devices. And then we created it in such a manner that the technology is post-quantum secure. So hence Agile PQ, Agile Post-Quantum. And that's where the name of our company came from. And that's in essence what we do. We deploy not only encryption, but a host of different technologies to secure these IoT devices, both now and in the future.
And I know that we talked about earlier before this, the Keyspace innovation. Do you want to explain exactly what that is?
Sure. So one of our post-quantum security methods is developed in the issuance of key. So if you're going to encrypt a message, you have to have a key that's known by the sender up front, and that key has to be distributed securely to the receiver on the back end of the message. And the key on the front encodes or encrypts the data. The key on the back end decodes or decrypts the data. Typically in the encryption on your smartphone, those keys are about 32 bytes in size. If you look at those 32 bytes, there will be a certain number of configurations of those 32 bytes that can be used by arranging them in a different way or through a different process or whatever. The total configuration of all of those bytes is called the key space. How large is that key space? And how much data would a computer need to crunch through to find the right combination to break that key? That's known as the key space. One of the innovations that we did was we reduced the operating code of the encryption that's on your smartphone today. We reduced it so significantly that we were able to not only have a fully functioning encryption system on the smallest of IoT devices, we were able to increase the size of those keys from 32 bytes to 288. That means that the key space, the total key space that a computer would have to crunch through in order to break that key, the total combinations of all of that data, our key space is over 400 orders of magnitude larger than that is on your smartphone. So not only did we create an encryption and a security, a data security technology that worked on a small device, we made it so that our key space was so large it cannot be broken by a quantum computer.
We were talking before about the hesitancy of companies to replace their technology. What is the normal lifespan of a technology? It probably makes sense to start thinking about this today because there could be quite a large number of them, and replacing them could be very costly. What's the incentive for them to do it today?
That's a very insightful comment, and you're exactly right. The average lifespan of a network system is probably in today's world around 15 years. They're costly. They need to utilize new technology, and companies and entities and governments look at how to deploy those constantly and when they need to replace them. There's a lot of people that look at quantum computers and they think, oh, it's going to be another 15 or 20 years before they come online and can break encryption. There are others who think it's 10 years, but increasingly more and more people are starting to realize that it's much shorter than that. In fact, it's likely 5 years and perhaps less. If you've got an IT network system that is built to last about 15 years and you're deploying that today, what that means is that system, if it's not post-quantum secure today, will be breached when post-quantum computers come online. So being able to deploy systems that are post-quantum secure today is critical. And we encourage companies and boards of directors and government officials, please look at post-quantum security right now. And the U.S. government, I want to make sure that people know and understand this, they are really focused on this. They are understanding it. The key departments of the government that would be impacted the most and across the board by quantum computers, the DOD, the military, NSA and security agencies, alphabet agencies, transportation, commerce, those groups, Homeland Security is another one, are tremendously focused on getting post-quantum security as rapidly as they can get it. And they are doing that. Now, if we want to find an example of why that's important, all you got to do is look in the papers over the last 2 weeks and look up a simple little hack called SolarWinds. And you become really aware that this is necessary.
Yeah. And a lot of people would say that if the U.S. government can experience in its critical agencies the largest hack in history, that's substantial. What does this mean for my enterprise? How well positioned am I against? I'll share a story that I didn't share before. When I was starting off in the cyberspace, I was working with a group that was heavily involved in the government and had some Secret Service connections. And we ended up picking up a client who was operating a home medical business out of his home and had been invited to a foreign country. I'll even leave the foreign country out of it at this point for a convention. Then when he came home, literally everything started being hacked. His computer, his car phone, his television set, basically any device in his house was being hacked. By the time we got involved, it was dominating his life. And it turns out that it was one of the most advanced hacking groups in the world, had originally started out attacking his small company to get the technology. And actually, oddly enough, and this is an ironic but comical part to the story, is that after getting what they needed, they had left, but somehow he remained as a target in the dark forums because of all the technology he had deployed or misdeployed, and it was a way for them to take target practice. So it shifted from this horrible group that took what they needed and left, and then it still perpetuated itself, and it was a complicated mess. But you're talking about a very small business, and his life was just, it was dominated by this hacking event.
And now you look at SolarWinds, which is a network management system that was hacked. Many news agencies have pointed out that they believe that this was a massive intelligence coup by the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, where they leveraged some of the vulnerabilities in that SolarWinds network management system, and it gained access to their server, and then they trickled down clandestine update to thousands of customers and downloading malicious software. And it gave the Russians access to that network. It's now estimated, and I don't think we know yet and won't know the total number for quite some time, but it's now estimated that over 250 federal government agencies and businesses were affected by this. And that's just the ones that they know of now. And this can end up having very far-reaching implications. And there's two things that we have to consider there. One is, what are the implications now? But we really should start thinking about what should the implications be to stop this in the future.
Yeah. And certainly the scale of IoT in our lives is just going to increase substantially as more and more devices, a bigger network, and it could really ultimately impact not just the businesses, the governments at issue, but to the extent that there are algorithms being run on this data that are feeding other information sources. The scale of the potential issue, if IoT devices were hacked in mass, could extend well beyond just the applications, but actually to the information we think we understand about various critical infrastructure in our society.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. There's a lot of things that have come out of this recent attack that we need to ask a lot of questions about, including the National Security Agency and U.S. Cyber Command failed to detect that intrusion early on. And so it became vast and widespread and deep before that intrusion. 2 years ago, there was a new agency set up called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. That's to try to get to the bottom of these very kinds of things. But we now need to ask, does that have the necessary resources to defend the United States against an attack like this, and especially of this size and caliber? We need to ask how insecure the software is that our federal government is using and the companies are using that is in place now, but has tremendous impact if it's hacked. What are the economic incentives that drove that attack? I think we need to understand that. What were they trying to do? Our technology system and our companies today and our markets actually reward very rapid development of products, and they reward new features, and they reward spying on customers and users to collect and sell individual data. If anybody doesn't think that they have an incentive to do that, they ought to probably relook at Google and Facebook and Twitter and every social media account. They collect data on everybody, and they're incented to do that. But the market does not reward security or safety or transparency at all. And it doesn't reward reliability in the system or to create resilience in the system at all against those kinds of attacks. And I want to make sure that it's understood that a lot of things that we learn have come from a lot of other people. Some of the things that I'm talking about right now didn't originate in our company. SolarWinds had ignored a whole bunch of things that could have made their system more secure. One of which is it had moved its software development from the United States to Eastern Europe, where Russia has a huge influence, and then could use that environment in Eastern Europe to potentially get at the programmers. And these systems were moved there because it was cheaper than doing it in the United States. Short-term profit ended up becoming a priority over the product security. And companies need to look at those kinds of things and understand that we may need to pay more to be secure, but the necessity of that is huge. We just need to do it.
Yeah, certainly the aftermath of SolarWinds is going to be unraveled for, I think, years. And certainly CISA needs better funding to accomplish its mission, and obviously its increasing mission. While certainly offensive operations are an important part of the geopolitical landscape now, you got to ask questions. Your offensive operations might be phenomenal, but you better be thinking about your defense too.
Including what are our software procurement practices, especially in government? Regulations may be the only way, Eric, that we get to this, because it may be the only way to force companies to get real about this and provide the safety and security features for customers, including the government itself. Business has so far shown that they are not willing to make the changes on their own. And all of us in business don't want to see any more regulation than we absolutely have to. But all of us in business that understand the impact of the loss and theft of data begin to realize that there likely is going to have to be security legislation that forces companies to do this in order to make our entire society more secure and to live in a digital world. And take it away from commercial businesses and government and think about consumers. When consumers like you and me go out and buy a device to use in our homes, whether it's a smart coffee maker or an oven, or you mentioned light bulb systems that can be turned on or off from your smartphone half a world away. All of those kinds of things are there for us. But when consumers buy those, they assume that those devices are secure, but they are not. And that's what regulation may have to address in a very significant way.
And Amazon's choice isn't necessarily the choice for security, particularly if you're not considering it. So actually, it leads to another thing I wanted to ask you about, the standardization efforts around IoT and IoT security. I know in Europe, they have something called ETSI. I know we don't have anything like that here, at least yet in the US. But do you want to talk a little bit about where you see that going and what approaches do you think are likely to work?
Yeah, actually, the United States is beginning to pass legislation. It's different from ETSI, but they're beginning in the process now. So 2 years ago, the state of California passed a law that said any device that is going to be sold to a consumer must begin to have a minimum level of security. Now, unfortunately, what they addressed as minimum level of security was a username and a password. Those can be broken really rapidly. In fact, people can go out on the dark web and get software that breaks those very rapidly. So that's not necessarily the right provision, but looking at how do we begin to legislate that. About a month ago, the United States Congress passed some legislation that requires a minimum level of security on any IoT device that's being used by the United States federal government. And that includes now not only just a username and a password or an authentication or authorization system that's adequate, but it now starts to include encryption on the data that's flowing back and forth off of those devices. In our country, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, known as NIST, is largely responsible for the standardization efforts around encryption and security, and they are as well for IoT. And they currently have an effort to find what they consider to be a lightweight cryptography for use in IoT devices. But that process that they've undertaken isn't necessarily taking into account quantum computing attacks, which it does need to take into account. NIST has an effort around IoT that is a set of recommendations for manufacturers. It has a website that has a number of resources surrounding IoT. We are beginning to do that in the U.S. Europe is way ahead of us on this. They passed legislation quite some time ago that requires a rather healthy level of security on IoT devices for citizens of the European Union, even if they're not living in the European Union. And that's an interesting thing for companies to think about. So that kind of legislation is going to continue to come down the pike and is going to be needed. And I would suspect, I would hope that we will be at the table helping to craft some of that for the United States as we go forward and use our collective knowledge that we have from deploying some of these systems to help guide some of that. The United States government sometimes can do things in a vacuum.
Great. So I wanted to circle back to something I said I was going to circle back to, which is when you sit down with prospects today, how many of them get it? What's that customer discussion like?
It's really pretty rare for us to run into any potential customer who doesn't get the need. There are so many news articles, so many high-level and high-profile breaches and so forth that people get it. I don't think the knowledge that breaches are occurring and that security is low is a surprise to many people at all that would potentially be our customers. What the discussion centers around more for us is because we had to come up with a new system to put into the marketplace, our discussions are how secure is that system? Is it vetted and tested? Does it fit on our IoT device? How do we integrate that with our software and our hardware? What hardware requirements does it have? So because it's brand new and it hasn't been done before, we're really cutting our teeth and cutting the teeth through the industry on how this can be done. What processors should they be using? Now, in our particular case, we can use almost any processor because our code's so small. The smallest IoT devices have less than 100 what's called kilobytes in processing power, and that's extraordinarily small. But our technology, our algorithms for our encryption, as an example, only require 2 kilobytes of that 100. So they can operate on these extraordinarily small devices. Our discussions really focus around all that. We literally are continually educating the marketplace, constantly educating the marketplace. So much so, we just set up a process for doing consulting work. Because while we would like to do all of that consulting for free, we can't and stay alive. But because we are so leading edge, have been so leading edge, that becomes a very significant part of what we're doing and what we do with our customers. As time goes on, people are starting to understand more and more. I suspect that in the next 2 years, two things will be the case. One, the education level will be higher and people will understand more and there will be more knowledge workers working in cybersecurity on extraordinarily small IoT devices. And two, our technology will be prolific through those IoT devices and helping to secure them.
I guess one of the questions I was going to ask you, and I feel like you've answered already, which is what's your big, what is known as the BHAG, the big, hairy, audacious goal, is that your software would be prolific on IoT devices across the United States. What's your vision for 2021 for Agile PQ, and how quick do you see the adoption of your product?
So my big, hairy, audacious goal is that by being on your podcast, everybody in the world will now know about our technology, know about the problem, and our education level has raised, and that leads to more deployments very quickly. It's estimated that there's going to be somewhere between 45 and 75 billion IoT devices in the marketplace by 2025. There's already probably around 25 or 30. There will be 10 billion more devices deployed in 2021. I mean, our big, hairy, audacious goal would be, quite frankly, or our wish really would be, that regulations and legislation would force people to have to use a technology like ours, and it would be put on every one of those devices. That will drive a pretty reasonable market for us, I think, given the numbers of those devices. Now, we have to break that down into smaller implementable goals and go a step at a time, but we still have to do so much education in the marketplace. We're going to be undertaking a much richer public relations campaign this year to now start educating people in the marketplace, being on programs like yours, being able to get in the press, write white papers that people begin to look at and learn from, will all be key factors to what we're doing. And we're going to do some other things in the marketplace in the next couple of months that will, I think, make it much easier for people to adopt our technology very rapidly.
This was great to have you on the show. I've learned a lot, and you're a pleasure to speak to. Where can people learn more about Agile PQ and yourself?
Sure, absolutely. Agile PQ is, you can go directly to our website, which is agilepq.com, and get on our website. We have LinkedIn and Facebook and social media accounts. For me, I'm on LinkedIn under Paul Clayson, and you can find me very easily. If someone wants to email me directly, they're welcome. My email is pclayson, P-C-L-A-Y-S-O-N, at agilepq.com.
Excellent. Again, thanks so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure.
Eric, what a delight to be with you, and I enjoyed our interview. Thank you.